The project of unifying Europe has been ongoing for more than half a century now, and I've been an enthusiastic supporter of it all my adult life. But I do think it made a wrong turn in the 1990s when a decision was made to accelerate a common currency at a time when it was probably still premature. If now after 12 years, we can see that there are some fundamental flaws in this project, foundational flaws, that are coming home to roost and are starting to become very important. I list them here for you. Because our time is brief, I will only, in my initial presentation, speak to the first one, but the second two, governance and ECB assets, are both extremely important, and we can go there in the subsequent discussion if you would like to do that. So what is the problem with the first? The problem is that there are too many countries in the euro. There are 17 countries, and they are too unlike each other to be sharing the common currency. In particular, for example, Germany and Greece are so incredibly different that they have no business being in the same currency together, and when they try, stresses develop. Now, the theory of optimal currency areas has been well worked out. Back in the 60s and 70s, people thought a lot about this, and some very good economists built a theory that said, here's what you need to have for an optimal currency area. You need to have similar inflation rates. You need to have fiscal and political integration, which is the step that is clearly missing here. You need to have price and wage flexibility. Why? Because if the currency union gives rise to stresses, as it does now, people need to be able to move, and wages need to fall. If you can't devalue Greece's currency, you have to let the wages and prices fall in Greece, and you have to let people move out of Greece and go to where the jobs are, like maybe Germany. And all of that is very stressful. It doesn't seem to be that we have the main conditions for optimal currency areas present. And above all, we don't have similar inflation rates. Although you might think that a common euro would make inflation rates be the same, it actually turns out not to be that way. So there are big differences between the countries. Germany has improved its productivity a lot in the past 10 years. They have exercised major wage restraint. They have liberalized many regulations. They have opened greatly to global competition, whereas Greece and Portugal and other southern countries have lagged in productivity growth. They've restricted competition through a web of regulations that are very discouraging. There are local monopolies all over the southern tier, and there are restrictive labor practices that get in the way of competition. This is a little chart I put together right off of Eurostat, simply taking the ratio of the German price index to the Greek price index before and after the founding of the euro. The little wiggles there come from the fact that this is not seasonally adjusted. But you will see a fascinating trend. You'll see the Greek prices from 96 to 2010 rise about 40% relative to German prices. And it doesn't change when they start sharing the same currency about in the middle of that chart. In other words, inflation proceeds more rapidly, and prices keep getting higher in Greece relative to Germany. Now, before the euro came along, the countries were able to handle differences in inflation and differences in productivity growth by changes in currency value. So theory tells us that what ought to happen is that a country like Germany with high productivity growth and low inflation ought to gradually have an appreciating currency, whereas Greece and Portugal, which are kind of the reverse, ought to have depreciating currencies. And that's exactly what happened prior to the formation of the euro in 1999. Here's a picture of it. I think many people in Europe imagined that they had succeeded in converging their currency values before the euro was formed, in anticipation of finally going to completion with this project. But as this picture shows, nothing of the kind happened. They continue to diverge. It's as if there is a pressure that pulled these currencies apart from each other. And as long as they did that, then trade could go on between the countries without impediment. What is absolutely fascinating about this chart is that the sequence in which the countries line up when you look at their pre-euro currency values is exactly the sequence in which they now have payments problems. We have Germany at the top, and at the bottom we have first Greece, then Portugal, then Italy, then Spain, and so forth. And it's not an accident that this picture predicts the payment problems, because this is the source of the payment problems. The fact is, the history of currency unions is not encouraging. It's an idea that has been tried often in modern times. But currency unions don't ever seem to last more than about 10 to 15 years. And they are almost always undermined by payments problems. So what happens is, if they ought to be pulled together, and if they ought to be devaluing or revaluing with respect to each other, and you don't let them do that, then a payments imbalance begins almost immediately. And here is my picture of that. So on this chart, I'm looking at the aggregate current accounts. And the aggregate current accounts of Germany and Netherlands are above the line, and everybody else in the union is below the line. And look at that picture. Before the euro was formed, which is the black line in the middle, trade roughly equalized among these countries because they were able to adjust their currencies. So trade could expand. It wasn't inhibited by currency value. As soon as you start the euro, suddenly an enormous payment imbalance develops between North and South. And when I first looked at this picture, I just was amazed. I thought, this is doomed. It can't last, because what this represents is a debt building up from the South to the North in a kind of exponential way. Exchange rates make a big difference. Here is a related picture of what happened to industrial production in Germany versus Italy with the formation of the euro. Exchange rates really matter, and they give rise to this kind of difference in economic performance and payments imbalance.
So I think in this time of crisis, we sometimes forget that there's another side of the story. There's a reason, of course, why these countries entered into this monetary union in the first place. So I want to take a few minutes to talk about both macroeconomic costs, and there I'll talk about some of the things that David touched on, but also some of the macroeconomic benefits of the European Monetary Union. So let me start with this picture of euro area government gross debt as a percent of GDP. This is a 2011 forecast. And here, of course, you can see the outliers that we're all used to seeing in red. Countries like Italy, Portugal, Ireland, and Greece. These are countries that we know are embroiled in crisis now, the countries that we feel have suffered greatly in some sense from the crisis associated with the euro area. But it's important to remember that these are also, in a sense, the countries that benefited the most from the formation of this European Monetary Union. So here's a picture of interest rates on 10-year government bonds over the period 1995 to 2011. You can see the introduction of the euro and, of course, the more recent crisis. And what you can see from this is that it's exactly these same countries, countries like Greece, Ireland, and Portugal, that experienced really big declines in the interest rates at which they were able to borrow associated with the formation of the European Monetary Unions. So essentially, associated with the EMU, you saw this remarkable convergence of interest rates, essentially to the interest rates that countries like Germany were paying to borrow on their debt. And even these countries were able to borrow at these low rates. Now, perhaps it's not surprising that there was a major decrease in perceived inflation risk associated with the start of the euro area. It might be more surprising in retrospect that people saw perceived such a big decline in the risk of literal default by these countries. It might seem surprising that that's what people perceive, given what's happening today, given that it seems like, in fact, that risk of literal default is not, in fact, so low. But in any case, you can see that there was a major impact for these countries in terms of the rates at which they were able to borrow over this time period. And of course, since then, this is somewhat unraveled. I also want to mention that in some sense, these types of benefits should be familiar from our own country. So here I'm drawing on a diagram from the Nobel Prize lecture by Tom Sargent. And what he points out is that there's an interesting parallel between the euro area crisis today and things that have happened in the history of our own country, the United States. So in the case of the United States, of course, we know that today the US is both a fiscal and a monetary union. We share the same exchange the same currency across different states, and also the federal government has powers to both tax, has strong powers to both tax and spend. But in fact, it wasn't always the case. So back in the late 1700s, the federal government had much reduced powers to tax. So it was much, the United States was much less of a fiscal union than it is today. And in exchange for increased powers to tax, there were actually a sequence of important bailouts of the states in the late 1700s. Now, subsequently, it was sort of realized that perhaps this was not a good precedent. And over time, in the early 1800s, so there were big run-ups of state debts during that period, but there was an explicit decision during that period not to bail out the states, and there were actually a number of state defaults in the early 1800s. So over time, there was this evolution in the case of the United States, starting out being perhaps a monetary union, but not so much of a fiscal union, into a true fiscal union, and also the establishment of this explicit policy not to bail out the states. So now let me just spend a few minutes talking about the costs of a monetary and fiscal union to relate to what David mentioned. So from the perspective of macroeconomics, a very important cost of a monetary union is associated with the reduced amount of labor market flexibility. So here I think it's interesting to compare the cases of Europe, countries which have a fixed exchange rate, with countries that didn't have a fixed exchange rate, and in particular I'm going to mention the case of Argentina. And here I'm borrowing slides from my colleagues Martina Ribe and Stephanie Schmidt-Broke in the economics department. So here is a picture of the evolution of the current account deficit, of wages, the labor cost index, and of the unemployment rate for the peripheral European countries. And this is over the period between 2002 and the present. And you can see that in the run-up to this crisis, there was this enormous group, that's this period here, this enormous party where you saw a huge current account deficit, enormous capital inflows, and a major declines in the unemployment rate. In 2008, there was this enormous sudden stop, this incredible sudden stop. We saw a very rapid reversal of the current account deficit and a rapid increase in the unemployment rate. Now take a look at the case of wages. So over this period of this enormous boom, there was this very rapid increase in wages. But then, when you come to this sudden stop in 2008, while it's true that the pace at which wages were rising sort of declined, there was no decline in wages. So there was no decline in wages. Wages stayed, you know, pretty high, and they were already at this very elevated level. You know, you can look at the fact that they rose by, you know, something like 80% over this period, and they remained high, and the unemployment rate rose dramatically over this period. And of course, this is associated with the fact that these are countries that had a fixed exchange rate. So to contrast this with the case of a country with a flexible exchange rate, if you look instead at the case of Argentina, so here is Argentina over the period between 1996 and 2006, and of course they had a major devaluation in 2002. Here, if you take a look at the nominal wage in the lead up to this period, it looks sort of similar. So from the perspective of the nominal wage, there was an increase over this period, and then over the period of the crisis, actually the nominal wage continued to increase. However, in 2002, so Argentina was a little bit different because, of course, this was not a boom in the preceding period. But in 2002, at the time of this major exchange rate devaluation, this exchange rate devaluation was associated with a major decline in the real wage. So even though nominal wages, as you can see here, actually continued to increase over this period, if you look at the real wage in the right-hand graph, you see that there was a dramatic decrease in the real wage. And then if you look at the unemployment rate graph, you can see that this is exactly the point in which there was a turning point in unemployment. So this is the power of flexible exchange rates. If you take a look, you know, on the one hand, in the case of Europe, you see that the nominal wages continued to increase, but because of the fixed exchange rate, that was what was happening to real wages too. In contrast, in the case of Argentina, there continued to be these increases in nominal wages, but there was actually a dramatic decline in the real wage associated with this massive exchange rate devaluation in the case of Argentina. So we all know what happened in the case of the United States. The United States moved increasingly in the direction of being both a fiscal union and a monetary union. We face similar issues to this, similar costs to this in the United States today. So we know that there were major problems, for example, in the auto industry in the past few years. If we'd had a flexible exchange rate, there probably would have been a major devaluation between Michigan and the rest of the United States, and that might have helped the adjustment. But of course, that didn't happen. We decided that the benefits of a fiscal and monetary union outweighed the costs, but we also decided that it was hard to have a monetary union without also having a fiscal union and strong powers of taxation. So I think these are the questions, whether Europe wants to become more integrated and go further in the direction of the U.S. model, or perhaps if it wants to go more in the direction of a small open economy. These are the questions that I think will be resolved in the future.
So I'm going to talk a little bit about the European credit crisis in a context of what's been other recent credit crises that we've had in the last few decades. So one surprising thing is if you think back over the last 20 years, almost all of the developed countries in the world have had a major credit crisis now. So in the 90s, we had the late 80s and then throughout the 90s, and I guess continuing to now, the Japanese crisis caused by a real estate and a stock market bubble led to a banking crisis. In the US, we had a real estate bubble, which then subsequently led to a banking crisis. And in Europe, we have a sovereign debt bubble, it appears, that seems to be leading to a banking crisis and potentially also a break of the monetary union. So I want to talk a little bit about what happened in these past situations. So necessary conditions for a credit crisis, you need sort of a large macro scale mispricing of credit. You need a propagation mechanism, so there's an initial shock, and then there's something that sort of propagates the shock and almost magnifies it. And this is often undercapitalized banks and bad risk management practices. And then I think third, there's a misrecognition of the core problem by regulators and central bankers who then use liquidity tools to try and fix a solvency problem. Okay, so let's just go back a little bit through what happened in Japan and in the US. So in Japan, in the real estate and stock market bubble in Japan started in roughly 1986 when the Bank of Japan decided to offset the Plaza Accord agreement, which Germany, the US, and Japan agreed to appreciate the yen. To offset that, the central bank decided to cut interest rates domestically. That then very quickly led to the Nikkei doubled in about 2 years, and then real estate values went up quite a bit. So part of the mispriced credit was caused by excess liquidity. Part of it was caused by, I think, extrapolation of past experience that house prices never go down. And real estate is good collateral because real estate values never fall. We also had bad bank problems in Japan, sort of false belief in effective regulation from people outside the banks. And then there's a failure to quickly write down losses. Japan didn't really deal with the bank losses until the mid-90s. In the U.S., same thing. We had mispriced credit. I would guess, again, it was due to the same things, excess liquidity, in part due to the Fed cutting rates in 2003 to very low levels and holding them there for a long time. Also, the shadow banking system providing excess liquidity to the system. And then we had the same problem with real estate, that people thought home and land prices never fell and were therefore good collateral. Again, bad risk management at the banks, false belief that somebody inside the banks was doing their job. And then as soon as the crisis sort of started in 2006, the Fed stopped raising rates and started to provide liquidity tools, again, treating a solvency problem with liquidity measures. So I saw this quote in Greenspan's biography, which is a good thing it was published before the crisis. So he said, speaking of the interest rate cuts in 2003, we were willing to chance that by cutting rates we might foster a bubble, an inflationary boom of some sort, which we would subsequently have to address. You have to be very careful what you ask for. When you cut rates to inject a lot of liquidity and house prices take off, it may be hard to sort of stop the beat. If we turn to Europe right now, we can see these same conditions. So we have mispriced credit. I think this is largely driven by the EU, ECB, and markets' dogmatic belief that the sovereigns in Europe can't default. Trichet sort of held this belief until he left the ECB. So bad credits were able to borrow at very low rates. There was also a large increase in sovereign debt holdings after the U.S. crisis by banks in Europe. Okay, so here's a picture of general government loans and securities held on bank balance sheets. So once the U.S. crisis starts, starting in 2009, European banks increased by 25% their holding of government securities, a lot of which were Greek, Portuguese, and so on. Okay, I'm not exactly sure why. I wouldn't be surprised if regulators told them this wasn't a bad thing for them to do. And then you can see from the earlier presentations, there's some structural imbalances which are going to make it difficult for some of these credits to pay it back. You need a propagation mechanism. Okay, Europe, unlike the U.S., has always been a very banking-centric economy. So if you look at banking system assets as a percentage of GDP, I think we have big banks. We're actually over here, right, which is the lowest in the world. And then a lot of the problematic European countries are over here. And even a country like Germany, right, as a banking system as a percentage of GDP, roughly twice ours. So the European banks sort of look like giant hedge funds holding lots of securities, holding not so many loans. And a lot of the securities they hold are government bonds. One nice thing about the U.S. crisis is we didn't have this problem. So there was no sense that a sovereign debt concerns about the U.S. government would cause problems at the banks. And the reason was, if you look at treasury holdings, who holds the U.S. government bonds, this little black line here are commercial banks in the U.S. Commercial banks in the U.S. have never held very many U.S. treasuries. What that meant is the U.S. federal government could issue TARP and then effectively bail out the banks because there wasn't this tight relationship between them. And then in Europe, you also saw this misdiagnosis of illiquidity for insolvency. So at first, people just thought it was a liquidity problem. When Greece announced their problems, the first thing people did was said, okay, well, we're going to finance Greece and you sort of fix the problems, ignoring the underlying economics that were indicating it probably was a solvency problem. And this also led to a failure of sort of, in the case of Greece, the default, and a failure to quickly write down losses. Okay, so at some level, this looks exactly like prior credit crises. Okay, and I just want to stop with a quote. So we have this quote that we often hear that those who cannot remember the past are condemned to repeat it. So there's two other ones which I think are maybe more relevant. So the first is from Bertrand Russell, that we learn from history that we learn nothing from history. Even though the people at the Fed and the people at the ECB had studied Japan, I assume people at the ECB had studied the U.S. credit crisis, it seems like we're going through exactly the same steps again. And then the final quote is by a sort of famous psychologist. It's frightening to think that you might not know something, but it's more frightening to think that, by and large, the world is run by people who have faith they know exactly what's going on. So in Emmy's talk, in the U.S., we were fortunate in the late 1700s and early 1800s to have Alexander Hamilton, actually I think a graduate of Columbia. He was one of those rare regulators that seemed to understand absolutely everything and know all the pieces. And he was able to make the good decisions to decide what to do, which subsequently sort of led to the, you know, I think, a lot of the strength of the U.S. It's not clear to me that either at, you know, places like the Fed or the EU or the ECB that the regulators, the people in charge, really have a grasp of the problem. And at some level, that's the truly scary thing, because despite the fact that we're repeating the same steps that other well-established rich countries have gone through recently, for whatever reason, we can't stop ourselves from going down that same path. Talk about the impact of euro crisis for other regions, using Asia as an example. We talk about the framework that I find useful when thinking about these questions. There are primarily two channels of transmission of this negative shock that I want to focus on. One is the trade channel, the other is channels through financial flows. Let me start with the trade channels. Again, an Asian example, one thing we often comment on is the fact that most Asian countries have very, very high export to GDP ratio. So for example, Chinese trade to GDP ratio is 37% for a large economy that's very, very high in countries like the United States, which is about 10% or less. Trade open is higher for East Asian than for South Asian, so there's some differentiation within the region. The first point I want to make is that this raw trade openness number is could be very misleading because in judging how dependent a country is on across, you know, most countries nowadays are participants of global production chains. So the true, you want to think about the dependence of the economy on the external market, what you want really need to look at is the ratio is domestic content in the country's export to GDP. To figure out you know, how to compute domestic content in country's exports, take into account global production chains, develop a framework with Ronald Koeman and Zhu Wang. Using that framework, we estimated that, you know, for example, for China, the true trade dependence, economies' dependence on trade, on domestic content and share of GDP is roughly 50%. So, you know, iPad is an extreme example of this. China is the world's largest exporter of iPad. The most things that start with I comes from Chengdu, China, central China. But the Chinese value added in the exports is very, very small, 10% or less. For the country, for the all the exports as a whole, that's the ratio is about 15%. So let's do a thought experiment. Suppose Chinese export to Europe is reduced by 15% due to new global prices. It's probably more dramatic than you will get. And this, so what would this do to Chinese Chinese growth? Well, you know, Chinese export to GDP ratio, a headline number is about 37%. Taking into account domestic content is only slightly over half of this, 18% of GDP. Domestic content in exports to Europe is about 5% of GDP. Cutting this by half means, if nothing else is changed, holding everything else constant, Chinese GDP could go down by 2.5%. Much smaller than headline number, but still not trivial. Of course, we shouldn't make hold other things constant. To understand you know, how a euro shock will do the Chinese growth or any other country's growth, we'll have to take into account, you know, the ability of a country to replace a lower external export demand by commodities, particularly domestic, including to what degree country can use domestic demand to offset lower foreign demand. And the answer to that question depends largely on two things. One is how truly dependent the country is on external exports, which is largely determined by country's size, and the other is fiscal capacity. Does the country really have the ability, weapons in its arsenal to offset foreign demand if needed to? And there, you, once you think about that, you realize that country conditions matter. There's no homogeneous effect. So let me talk about four examples. Singapore, India, Philippines, and China. So Singapore is a country that has a very strong fiscal position, often runs surplus, but so small, virtually everything that Singapore firm produces is for foreign market, for those other populations. And therefore, the euro shock, major shock of this respect, very dramatic drop in Singapore growth in the economies. India has the size of a very large continental-sized country. It could offset the foreign demand with domestic demand, except for the fact that it has a very weak fiscal system. The Indian government, like the U.S. government, has been running deficits year after year for the last decade or so, which makes it very hard to use policy tools to generate additional domestic demand. Philippines has the advantage of both being small and have weak fiscal positions. Expect it to be hit very hard by a euro crisis. In comparison, China has the advantage of being very large, so domestic demand is important, and has comparatively healthy fiscal position. You know, a bit less healthy than 2 years ago, but still healthy relative to most other major economies, and therefore this, it could strong the ability to offset foreign demand. This may think if euro crisis gets into us, in fact, that trade channel will not translate into dramatically terrible outcome for a country like China, but could be more terrible for the economy. The second channel is financial growth. Most countries in Asia are very open, including China, on that regard. The overall capital flows to GDP ratio is very high for most countries, but there's interesting differentiation there as well. To think about, you know, how would contraction in Europe, a worse contraction than what it is now in Europe, would do to emerging markets, it's useful to think about two things. One is
exposure to financial risk, to the volume exposure. The other is very importantly the structural exposure. What is the structural capital flows? That's going to be very, very important. Why is it important? So here's a picture of the different type of capital flows from high-income country to emerging markets over the last 16 years century, so the 10 years of the century. This is sort of like looking at the contrast between different flows, like presidential candidates trying out. Some are relatively stable and foreign direct investment, told blue. Others are a bit more volatile and optimistic. So, portfolio flows bouncing around. Bank loans in particular. So, when there's a contraction in either US or Europe, there's a dramatic reversal of international banking flows. Implication of this is those countries that are relatively dependent on borrowing from foreign banks, Korea is an example of this, or portfolio flow tend to be hit harder than those countries that rely relatively more on foreign direct investment, like China's example of the latter. So again, so country conditions, I mean, as I just said, Korea has high volume exposure and rely relatively more on foreign bank flows, so they make it particularly vulnerable to the financial chain of foreign contraction. India has medium level exposure, but also rely relatively more on non-FDI flows, which make it also somewhat vulnerable to a further worsening of the global crisis. China has high total volume exposure, but the structure is such that the primary due to capital control regime is that capital flows is overwhelmingly in the form of foreign direct investment, as we see from the previous picture, which make it comparatively less vulnerable to a worsening financial crisis. Just to sum up, a deepening crisis in Europe is not good thing for anyone, certainly not good thing for countries in Asia. But it creates differentiations. So one line summary would be, perhaps China will emerge relatively stronger than some countries out of this crisis.